You are listening to Her Brotherhood. I'm your host, Abby Bolt. This is where we celebrate women who put their lives on the line and triumph over tragedy. Now, in this episode, I am nothing short of honored to share with you our first guest, San Diego Fire and Rescue, Trisha Zip Paulette. My career as a wildland firefighter is what led me to first meet Trish. Through an interagency leadership program, we were introduced, and the immediate words that come to mind when I look back on that are kind, humble, and inspiring. You will hear some wonderful stories in this episode, but I have to share with you why she is Her Brotherhood's first interview. It wasn't too long after I met her that she and her husband Bruce, who was also a San Diego firefighter, found themselves in what seemed like endless gunfire at the Mandalay Bay Hotel in Las Vegas. They were there to relax and be on vacation. They had no idea that it would turn into a more terrifying and deadly incident than they had ever faced on the job as firefighters. And just like all first responders do, they sprung into action because it isn't conscious, it's instinct that drives these people to do what they do. However, things got even worse when Trisha's new friend standing next to her was shot in the heart, and then her husband Bruce was shot as well. Not long ago, I was in a pretty low point early last year going through some difficult times, and I decided I wanted to put that energy into creating the Her Brotherhood podcast. I wanted to funnel all of the pain and frustration I was feeling into something positive. So often women in careers like mine are in the media for things like harassment and assault. So I came up with the idea of finding a way to celebrate the women who put their lives on the line, not just in fire, but military, law enforcement, you name it. Against my emotions, I let my significant other talk me into going to the National Annual Hotshot Reunion that was located in San Diego. And we can talk about that later and about how wonderfully supportive my brothers in fire were in an episode down the road. But I was truly struggling. I made it through, and on the first night, we went to meet Trish for dinner. I was afraid to ask her about the shooting, but she was more than willing to talk about it. And when she explained the experience, challenges, and how she got through it all, to the point where she could actually talk to me about it at dinner without crying, I knew that she had to be the first interview. I asked her, and Trish Paulette agreed with a smile in full support of my efforts. As expected, life got in the way, and I wasn't able to kick off the first episode as soon as I'd hoped. But Trish kept telling me whenever I was ready, so was she. The next time I saw her in person was at one hell of a shindig for her retirement in a historical San Diego firehouse. She is now in beautiful Montana, enjoying all of the hard work and sacrifice she made in her career. Now that you know how we got here, please sit back, relax, and enjoy the story of this amazing woman, Trisha Paulette, who I am proud is a part of Her Brotherhood.
I'm Trisha Paulette, and I am in Big Fork, Montana at my home. I've been here 1 month exactly, so it's very exciting. This is my new adventure in retirement after 29 years or almost 29 years with San Diego Fire Department. I retired and I'm now living a whole new dream.
Ever since you just said Big Fork, Montana, now I can't even stop smiling because that just, I see the smile on your face because we're Skyping right now. We can see each other, and I know how lit up you are, and that's pretty cool. So I think it was like what day after you guys had your retirement party, or did you have your truck packed when you were having your retirement party? Was it already packed? Because I swear you guys were on the road right after.
Yeah, we were mostly packed. My last day was the 11th, and that was the night of our party on January 11th. And then on Monday morning, we were on the road headed out.
That is so cool. Now you say we, so who is we?
My husband, Bruce, and I, who also retired from San Diego Fire Department.
That is so cool. So you guys both, what were your retirement dates right next to each other? Pretty close, or?
He retired a week before me. So he retired on the 5th, and then I just stayed one extra week to finish up some projects and the transition.
Nice. So he can always say that he got out before you.
Yeah, exactly.
Right on.
I had a whole week to tell him nobody likes a quitter.
That's awesome. Very cool. Now, the way that I even ever met you, which I think is interesting, is because your fire department was actually connected with the wildland community. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah. Our fire chief, Brian Fennessy at the time, had worked for the Forest Service. And so he started bringing in a leadership program, the NWCG leadership curriculum. And I was actively involved with teaching that and met a lot of people who work for the Forest Service and BLM and had the wonderful opportunity of doing some teaching of leadership classes in Montana and Idaho and in California, also different parts of California. And through that, I met a bunch of people who have kept me connected in lots of different ways.
Because I never would have met you if you weren't connected with us. And how, like in your department, how many people did this leadership program or really intertwined with the Wildland folks?
We probably had 15 to 20 of our department members who were teaching the leadership stuff. But we also have a ton of our people who go out on management team assignments and single role assignments. So with all the different, and even going out on strike teams and as a strike team leader going out on fires, I got to hang out with a ton of people who I'd not only met through the leadership curriculum and program, but also who then I met as friends of friends. So it's a pretty small community. And you're right, with the details that you guys get to do in the Forest Service, it's been so fun with different places I've worked to meet different people as they rotate in and move around.
You retired as a battalion chief, right?
Yes.
With San Diego. And so I want to know how this cliche question that we all have to ask each other is, how in the world did you get into firefighting?
I, for some reason as a kid, I had thought about it and thought it was, you know, I probably every kid, you're interested, you see the fire engine, it just looks amazing. I was in high school and my best friend through junior high school and high school was a guy whose dad worked for San Diego Fire Department. And two of my best friends were boys, men now, just through hanging out with them. And he knew that the fire department was recruiting women and some of the gals they were bringing in were not necessarily a great fit or not maybe as understanding of guys. And so because he knew I already had those relationships and got along well, he started teaching me about the fire service and ran me through the physical agilities test. And I absolutely fell in love with it. Decided to go to San Diego State for a year because my plan had been to get a degree and become an athletic trainer. And after a year at San Diego State, I just couldn't stop thinking about being a firefighter. So I abandoned that path and started taking classes in fire technology.
That is so cool. So it would be fair to say you kind of grew up like a tomboy.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I was raised by a single mom. So my best friend, Kim, growing up since second grade, her father really helped raise me. And then Scott's dad, Mac, had also been a huge influence once I got into junior high and high school. So it was really more me wanting to be a tomboy than me being brought into. I had a boyfriend and I'd hang out with him in auto shop. So it was just something that I think when I was younger, I didn't have, and it just really interested me. So I started finding opportunities to learn those things that I had no exposure to.
Well, and I find that a lot of people raised by just the mom because they want their daughters to be strong and independent. And, you know, they seem to kind of navigate toward those places because I'm sure your mom wanted that for you.
Yeah. And she was very strong and independent too, raising three girls and being the sole provider was a big job for her, for sure.
So you were how old when you actually got into the department?
I was 21. I had just turned a few months before I started.
Nice. And did you do anything else for a job at all before that? Did you wait tables? Did you do anything different?
I did a lot of things. I started working when I was 16 years, actually 15 and a half. So I'd worked at McDonald's and I worked at a pizza place and I worked at a Mexican restaurant waiting tables and serving. I taught aerobics and did some personal training through a couple different health clubs. They put me through their training program, so I stayed pretty physically active as well. And along the athletic training thing, I had worked at a sports medical center, the physical therapy office.
Oh, wow.
I was a physical therapy assistant. I do ultrasounds and ice packs for the patients that would come through and
wow,
help them through their exercises.
21. That's awesome.
All that before 21. Yeah.
That is cool. Not a lot of people get that much experience before then.
Yeah.
So
with my mom being a single parent, I tried to work and help pay for some of the things through high school.
Tell me about like getting into the fire service. You knew you wanted to do it. It was eating you up. How did you get in there? What was that like?
So taking classes at the local junior college that had the fire technology program was huge. at the junior college, I was able to start taking classes and networking. It was funny because my friend's father, who had started me down this path, at one point basically said, look, you're going to figure this out. So go off on your own, take classes at the college, start networking, and I know you, you're going to be fine. I did, and I felt kind of abandoned at first, but I realized later that he just really wanted me to find my way, and he wanted me to meet people and not have it be the association with him as much as me setting my own path.
As so, a favor to you, I'm yep. sure. He didn't want you to get tagged with like, oh, well, she just knows so-and-so.
Maybe, yeah. That very well could be too. Yeah, so I started taking classes and got involved with the EMT program. That was where we all had to start. Did not have to be an EMT to get on the department. You do now. But everybody told me that was the best way to go. So I actually, the first 4 weeks of my academy was redoing the EMT class, which was great because I was already ahead that I had that. But it was the testing process was basically an application, and we had 6,000 people that applied for the position back in 1989. And actually, our department has gone down in recent years. We've had some application periods where they've extended them trying to get more. So San Diego City has some challenges. Some of the employers and the benefits they offer make other cities and other areas more desirable.
I think, too, is like back then you didn't have to be an EMT. You know, now you got to have your EMT, your firefighter one. So it really does narrow it down a lot more than it used to, I suppose.
Absolutely. Yeah, you have to put those extra efforts in. And depending where you are in life, if you're in a place where you've got a family and you can't afford to take the classes or take the time out to do other things, sometimes it's challenging. But a lot of people are doing it and making that sacrifice. And I think that's one of the things that the more they've done when they go to get hired, it's more for the interviewers to look at to see that they really have put some effort into this, and some people great lengths. And those stories go far in showing their resilience, their dedication, and their ability to achieve their goal, regardless of how hard it may be for them.
Really good point. How many were in your academy when you went?
At that time, we had the largest academy in San Diego history. We had 42 people in it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was a big group.
And now, out of those 42, how many were women?
We had, I want to say, 8. There was still a big push to try to get women on the department. The city of San Diego did not want to have affirmative action forced on them, so they were trying to do the equal opportunity employment. So we had, I'm pretty sure it was 8 women go through, and I think 6 of us made it. I believe, I know for a fact, 2 did not.
So were there men also that got washed out?
Absolutely.
That's what I know. When people hear that, they think that, oh, the girls got washed out. It's like, no, the dudes get washed out too. Like, it's not just.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was performance-based, and you took tests, and there was no misscoring. You know, you either passed the written tests or not, and all of the physical certifications were done in groups, and it was the same thing. There was a time standard. You either passed it or you didn't. There were skill standards where if you didn't complete the task with the appropriate level of detail, you know, and making sure you hit all of the steps, those were all things that could wash you out.
Interesting. So what really flashes in your mind about your academy and about that time?
I absolutely loved, and it's funny because a lot of people are like, oh God, the academy. But I loved how close we were with the people we had. Mm-hmm. I love the feedback. I mean, even though there was always that fear of failure and not meeting the standard, I loved that every day I knew exactly where I stood. I was getting continuous feedback of what I did right and what I needed to improve on. And so tomorrow I could be better. I could choose mm-hmm. to do what I needed to do to be better. And one of the things that is sad is as you move up in your career, that really goes away. The feedback is a lot less. And one of the things I always tried to do was tell my supervisors and the people working for me as well, I can't succeed without your feedback. So I'd always try to voice that I wanted their input, that I wanted to hear what I was doing to help them succeed and where I was falling short of them, whether it's meeting their goals or serving our team. And I think that's one of the hardest things to do is to give people feedback. Mm-hmm. So I really tried to create an invitation at least so they knew that I wanted it. I still think it's hard as you get higher in your career.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think the more adult people become, it's like the older they get, the more they're afraid of confrontation and they're afraid to even open that door of, you know, saying something or documenting it or just walking up to you and be like, you could do a little better at XYZ. You know, it is hard. And do you remember anything, any of the feedback you got or any of those moments where either I've got to improve on this or someone told you like, Trish, you have to up that? Or was there a moment in your academy where you were like, I might not be strong enough to do that?
I remember a time where I was one of the captains who was absolutely just such a role model and such an amazing person to be around. And I was working so hard. It was the end of the day. The hose was soaking wet. I was pulling it up onto the roof of our training tower that was 4 stories high. My partner had, not intentionally, but my partner had actually laid the hose backwards. So instead of pulling it up from a coil, I was actually pulling it up from the bottom. So the weight of all the other hose was weighing it down as I was trying to drag it and pull it up. And I was just, I was working so hard and I was making a lot of interesting noises, I'm sure. And the training captain was amazing. He was, you know, just standing there cheering me on and encouraging me to do it. And I remember telling him afterwards, I said, well, I don't have any kids yet, but I'm assuming when I have my firstborn, this is probably what the labor and delivery room is going to sound like. And he just started cracking up and he said, my maiden name is Zip. He goes, Zip, I'll take you on my crew any day.
Oh, that's awesome.
So that was just one of those that, you know, it was setting my mind to the fact that I could not fail. And having him there being a positive role model and cheering me on was really helpful. That wasn't always the case. You know, there were some people that weren't as positive and weren't as encouraging throughout my career, even in life. And so I think that's a big thing, is realizing that if you're not getting it from outside, you've got to have it within, and you've got to have that own voice in your own head. That we all have our inner critics, but we need to have our inner advocate as well, I think.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. Going through that academy, so all those other women, and how did you feel perceived your first year, your rookie year? Did you feel welcome? I mean, that was in 89. It wasn't that long ago, but it was a while back where, you know, we weren't quite as developed in this. So how was it?
So it was actually 1990 when I finally got on the job. 89 was when I started. Yeah. So it took a little while to get through that testing process and get hired. But my academy was in 1990. You know, I think it was then not too much different than it is now. I think there were very mixed blends of people. And I came to find that I came across 3 different versions. There were the people who would support me. They'd take the time to get to know me, and they'd support me for who I was and the job I was doing. There were the people that no matter what I did were not going to accept me. And the nice thing was some of those people, it made it hard when we were actually working, but some of them wouldn't even talk to me. And so that was obviously difficult because, again, that whole feedback piece, right? I'm new. I'm trying to learn. I'm trying to improve. And if you're not talking to me, I don't know whether I'm doing it right or wrong.
Yeah.
So those were kind of hard. The ones that challenged me even more than that, though, were the ones who would, to my face, act as if they were a friend. And then they would ask me questions of, you know, what do you need to work on? What are some of the areas that you feel you're deficient? And I'd share that with them. And then they'd turn it around and go, do you believe she didn't know this and she, you know, couldn't do that? And would turn it around to being an attack on me.
Right.
And
use your
never
own ammo.
To my face. Absolutely. And never to my face, behind my back. So it was one of those things that luckily those people were few and far between. They definitely were not the majority. So, I mean, I think overall, I had an amazing opportunity throughout my career to work with wonderful people. You know, there's ups and downs in every relationship, but I think in the end, there were a lot of great people that I had the opportunity to work with and learn from.
There's far more good than there are bad.
Absolutely. And even those who challenged me, I still learned from them. even those who, you know, there's life lessons that I got from those people where, you know, how I shared my vulnerabilities changed. You know, I would be very specific about what, you know, certain things that I could improve on, but, you know, I wouldn't necessarily share what I didn't know before, or I just became very, I don't want to say guarded, but I definitely learned to guard a little bit and try to protect myself, I guess, to make sure that I was putting my best foot forward and not allowing anything to be used against me whenever possible.
Yeah, those vulnerabilities can, they can, if when somebody uses your vulnerability against you, it can really get you more than anything they could have made up.
Absolutely. And a lot of times I learned I'd make a joke on myself before anybody else could. If I knew it was coming,
yep,
I'd try to take the wind out of
Yeah, I was going to say, I already said that, so it's not going to do you any good. Right. Yeah. I'm right there with you. You've got the rookie year. So you've got Trish, all she's got under her belt. Oh, she went and got her EMT. Now she's got her cert from the Fire Academy. So shooting forward to once all the way through your career, once you're retired, because a lot of people don't realize, like, when they say, like, well, what do you know? What have you learned? What are you certified as? And when we start rattling off our credentials, it's overwhelming, right? Like when
right.
I was just going through years and years of fire training, trying to consolidate a bunch of stuff the other day. And it was like, oh my God, I forgot I got certified in this and this and this, you know? So when you're like, well, what are you? What do you do? So just give me the, like, Trish rattle rundown of what are you certified in or trained in?
You got it. So when I got on the fire department, my first couple years, my focus was just being a good firefighter. And then I became a paramedic. I had the opportunity to go through our paramedic training program and spent a couple years getting comfortable with being a paramedic. And then I started taking our specialized heavy rescue classes and confined space rescue and became an instructor at our rescue training program down in San Diego. And then I went to hazmat training, became a hazardous materials specialist. And that was actually how I ended my career, was managing that team as the program manager. After hazmat, that's when I started the promotion process, became a fire engineer. And after a couple years as a fire engineer, I was fortunate. I, at that point, had it almost 13 years on, I became a captain. And as a captain, I tried branching out to even more stations and specialties. Throughout that, all of that, I also got my State of California Master Instructor, the Instructor 3.
Uh-huh.
So I wanted to, everything that I was learning, I was teaching and trying to make sure that I could not only share my experiences, but the more I watched and learned from other people's experiences, it just opened a lot of doors and definitely helped me provide better emergency response in the time where you're trying to make the best decision for people and you're wondering, you know, what you know or what you can draw back to. That was one of the things that I really tried to beef up, was the experiences that I could draw back on to figure out, how am I going to make this call better?
So this was definitely not just a job for you, was it?
No, absolutely not.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely a way of life, and it's who you are. It's your lifestyle. Because just hearing your heart and how you care, you want it to be so much better for the people you served.
Oh, absolutely. And that was the one thing that I'm so happy I was able to end my career and never having to have anybody seriously injured or having to lose someone under my watch. And definitely as a captain and battalion chief, you're making decisions and putting people on assignments that could get them injured or killed. I'm not saying that it was my skill that kept everyone safe. I mean, at times I maybe was overcautious, but I definitely felt like it was my responsibility to at least know how to make the best decision possible and protect them in the best way I could, whether it was sending them in or keeping them out of a situation.
You know, people are always talking about those special skills that women bring to the job, and like it or not, right, wrong, or indifferent, I mean, just like talking to you and knowing you and putting someone like you in the job, like, we have that instinct, that care, that wanting to make sure, you know, sure, every guy does out there too, but, you know, you feel, I think women have a different kind of empathy and caring nature about them, to where, you know, we think about things a little bit differently than the men do, and we worry a little bit more. I just think about my son, like, when I'm working with people, I think about, how can I get him to come home safely? How can I get that guy home to his wife safely? You know, and I think we have a little bit of a different take on it than some of the men do.
Yeah. And I think the ethical dilemma of there are times where I know the organization had needs that were my responsibility to carry out, but I also knew that my crew members had needs and being with their families and getting the time off. And so trying to work in the middle and support that and definitely look at the people that I was working with, not as just employees and firefighters who we could work to the ground, you know, work them till they collapse, but recognizing that, you know, we need them to be able to be at their best. We need to give them time to recover and trying to pace, I guess, is the, and not just pace on a call, mm-hmm. but pace in a career and pace in life. And, you know, we all talk about work-life balance, but I think very few supervisors and workplaces, they may say the words, but to really live it and walk it is really challenging. And I know for myself, I didn't always do that. And I didn't always say no. I was so flattered if I was asked to work on a special project, the answer was always yes. And when I finally started saying, you know, I've got too many things going right now and it's affecting my family, I know that was, I don't want to say it was frowned upon, but I'll say it got to a point where unfortunately some people would stop asking, to where I'd even want to volunteer and sometimes wouldn't get selected because they're like, well, you know, we've already got people who've been working on this project, so we're going to stay with them. And
I'm okay to hear you say that is just because that's how I've been to that place. You know, and I'm the same like you. I couldn't say no because I wanted to be a part of everything, wanted to, you know, help with everything. And
yeah,
like you, I remember before I had, you know, before I had a son, I was like, what do you mean you're not going to work overtime? What do you mean you're not going to, you know, I think, do you feel like it was once you had that family and is that what shifted?
Yeah. When I got married, I didn't have any kids of my own. So Bruce had two kids when we got married, and that definitely, the kids were 4 and 7 and wanting to really build a strong relationship with them. And I really wanted to be there for them. So I did have to step back from some of my other commitments and step out of some of the things that where I had taken really lead roles and was doing a lot of extra work. When I started backing out, you know, it also made room for other people to come forward and step into it and learn things. So I tried to turn over the positions and to do it in a graceful way. But I mean, it's hard when you get left behind in the end, but right. I'm glad I did it. And I know my family benefited from it after spending the last weekend with my daughter and, aww. You know, just how great our relationship has become over the years. It's all worthwhile in the end, but you know, at the time it's hard when you're trying to do everything and you just can't.
No. I mean, and there's that sweet spot where you realize like there is something more important than work.
Absolutely.
You know? Yep. And then there's a light and, that comes on.
Yeah. Bruce was good about giving me that perspective. He definitely, we actually had some pretty good arguments in our first years of marriage about what level of commitment we were both going to keep maintaining at work and how much we were going to do.
So when you guys met, was he was a firefighter, obviously.
Yeah. So Bruce was we met many, many years ago and we'd been friends. Our department did an exchange program with some other fire departments when we became paramedics, but we didn't have ambulances. So we would rotate over to another department and transport on their ambulances and they would come work on our engines. So most of them were slower cities. They could come and work in busier districts in the city of San Diego, and we would get to work on their ambulances and get our paramedic experience. So that was when I met Bruce back in 92.
Okay.
And then fast forward years later, we ended up dating in 99, so 7 years later. But when I was telling you, so we had these arguments over what level of engagement we were going to have. And it was pretty funny because we finally came up with a written, we called it the compromise.
Wow.
And it was a written compromise after years and years. And it was no more than 1 week a year that we would travel out of town for something having to do with work. And it really, once we got that settled out and we came to a compromise of what would be agreeable for both of us, the other side caveat was at any point in time we could, you know, with the other person's agreement, we could go beyond that. So like if an amazing opportunity came up that was a 2-week out-of-towner.
Right.
Of course, Bruce, you know, would support me on that. And once we put it in writing, it was really funny because we rarely referred back to it. We just needed to agree
that
to that
so
balance.
Cool. I love that. And yeah. I want to know more about this later from you too, because I love that. I just love that concept. And is that something you guys just came up with? Just you're like, I think this will work? Or where'd you get that idea?
I think it was more just we kept going back and forth, and I'd say, well, I thought I could go for 2 weeks. No, we said one. So we're like, okay, that's it. We're putting it in writing. Let's get something that we can look back to. And when something comes up, before I would go to him with it, I'd read, okay, what can I do? How many ways does this violate the compromise? I'd review the policy to see how out of compliance I would be.
Right.
But it worked out great for us because it really just took out that stress of, and Bruce kept saying, I get it, that it's a great opportunity. But at that point in time, I had a lot of great opportunities coming my way, and I just couldn't say no. And so, I mean, really, he helped me put back the balance in my life that I had lost. And like you said, you know, we started out, we're young, we're single, it mm-hmm. becomes our life.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was good that he refocused me and put that balance back in my life. That compromise really helped.
That's great, because you don't hear very often that it's the man in the relationship that did that. So that's really heartwarming to hear that Bruce had that within him. And plus you had the 4 and 7 when you started, right? Like I think those are the ages, like especially around 4, where they're like, excuse me, but you need to be home this weekend. The kids, those are key ages, you know, and for you to, that's when you were integrating into with the children. And that's so cool. But definitely, like when they're little bitty, they don't even, they're like, where'd she go? I don't know. Did somebody feed me?
Right.
You know? But when they're older, they start to call you out and you realize. So that's really cool. You're able to be there for them. So how long have you and Bruce been married?
We got married in 2000. So we just celebrated our 19 year anniversary.
That's right. Well, congratulations. That's cool. I just
love you.
One of these days I want to do an interview with the both of you, because I think having both of you on and listening to things like about the contract would be, or the compromise, sorry, the compromise.
The compromise.
Yeah, very cool. So looking back at like your time as a captain, and we talked about, you know, getting your crew home safe and all of that. When you look back, one or two of the calls, like what's something that really comes to mind when you're like, but that one was close? That was sketchy.
We were out on a wildland fire, and we'd been working all day, you know, planning what we were going to do. They were going to do they just called it firing. And so getting someone to really commit to, are we trying to backfire or are we firing out? What exactly is the intent of what we're trying to do here? And they were kind of hemming and hawing. Well, by the time everything had been agreed upon and we were in place and the operation started, the wind shifted on us pretty quick after. We were supposed to keep it from jumping the road, and one spot became two spots, became an acre. And one of the engines out of our strike team, I was captain at the time, one of the 5 engines on our strike team had been pulled back to support the helicopters with water filling, and they saw it all happening. And as this huge cloud of smoke, they said it looked like a wave. They actually got a video of it. It was pretty impressive. The way the smoke cloud went over us like a wave, they thought we were all dead. And we ended up, one of our guys cut a hose line, and my crew had gone up to help with a larger spot fire. So my engineer and I was right between the two of them, and I had to decide which way to go. And I knew that my 2 firefighters were with another captain. My engineer was by himself. So I went to my engineer. I was calling on the radio. Things got so chaotic so quick. Nobody was coming up on the radio to get back to me on what was going on. And we didn't know it at the time, but we had lost our air resources. They had gotten pulled because it had taken so long for the operations to start that they had to go refuel.
Oh, wow.
So all just one more thing where you're like, okay, well, that wasn't very coordinated in the end at all.
Mm-hmm.
But it worked out great because my 2 firefighters did get on another rig with the captain. The strike team leader finally got back to me, told me they were okay. We all met up, but I'll have to send you a picture of the fire. There's the fire was called the Day Fire.
Oh, yeah.
It was one of the biggest fires in California history.
Yeah.
And it was fire, just a fire was doing a lot of things in a lot of areas, but I was just, I learned a lot that day on listening to other people and asking questions. And at the time, I think I just didn't, I assumed other people were going to ask the questions that we were asking of our strike team leader, that it was all going to keep getting pushed up. And at some point it didn't. So from that, I learned to speak up at whatever time it is and whoever the audience is. If my question isn't getting answered, I need to ask it.
Right.
Some of those valuable lessons.
The assumptions.
But that was, So even though we were mostly metropolitan structural firefighters, I think the area where we were in a lot of ways more vulnerable was when we were just a little bit out of our element doing things that we didn't do as often.
Right.
And definitely the firing operations are not something we do in the city of San Diego.
Right.
On a frequent
Thank
basis.
Goodness. So, I mean, looking at that, that it wouldn't have taken much for that Swiss cheese to line up and to have a tragedy. And I'm sure looking back at that, you guys, it's those close calls, though, that definitely make you better down the line.
Yeah, we were on CNN that night.
But luckily, it wasn't because of a fatality.
Correct. Yeah, it was. It showed the fire and the fire behavior. The video they got from on the freeway was crazy because they were overlooking the area where we were working on the Templin Highway. So they basically, they caught great footage and they caught one of our engines where they cut the hose and drove off with a little bit of the hose dragging and around CNN. But like you said, not that we lost anyone, just that there was some crazy fire behavior and we were out working hard.
Wow, that's insane. That's cool. So it's funny that the one that really strikes your mind is the wildland one, of course.
Yeah.
Because that's, like you said, a little bit outside of the element. Like, you can't put all those guys in a structure fire. That would, like all of our guys, all the wildland, it wouldn't work out very well. So because you guys are definitely better at ours than we are at yours. So that's good. Something that I always wonder about my structure friends, and having medical aids and all of that be such the bread and butter of a lot of your job. What, looking back, thinking about all the patients that you had and all the rescues that you had, what are some of the memories from that that really strike your mind?
Ooh, I've got a lot of memories from that. You know, there's three calls that really have, that really stuck with me, that were the more traumatic ones. And I feel like making it through my career with three very vivid, lasting images that are, that were ones that I had to actually work through. On one of them, for a month after the call, when I closed my eyes, I'd see the person's face. So, you know, those, luckily, there were only three of those, and I've moved through them to where I'm good. I'm at peace with all of that. But I can just think back to so many of the people that we were able to help and all of the little things that we were able to do. A cardiac arrest, a man went, they're in a movie, and he starts throwing popcorn. And he's a joker, so his wife thinks he's just messing with her. And she's like telling him, stop throwing the popcorn at me. And it turns out he was having a seizure. He actually went into cardiac arrest and collapsed in the movie theater. And we didn't know if we were going to be able to save him or not. He was in his mid-40s and was in the movie with his wife and two children. I had never done it before, but I just left a note on the chart saying, you know, we're from this engine company and we hope that all goes well. You know, if you feel the need to reach out to us, here's how you can get us. And I actually, we got a card from him two or three months later, maybe a little bit longer, but it was Christmas. Oh. And they sent us a Christmas card.
Wow.
And so he had made it, and he said that he had no memory of it. There was 2 weeks of his life that was just gone. There was a beautiful picture of them on vacation. So that type of stuff just really sticks.
That is really cool. That's a cool story.
Yeah.
That make me cry. That's super cool.
So I got to tell you one more really cool one too. He had a woman came into the fire station, and she was, she had been looking for the person who delivered her baby. So it turns out we had had a childbirth call. She was trying to get in the car and basically got to the door of the car in the garage and just sat down on the floor. And that, she said, I can't make it. We've got to do it here. So they called 911. We had helped deliver her baby there at the house and then transported her and the baby. And I was taking care of her because kind of that female connection and then my male partner was taking care of her baby. So it worked out perfectly. It was a few years later, she remembered that my name was Tricia. She had come by the fire station like 3 or 4 times to find me and never had. So I was at the elementary school, our kids' elementary school. I was on the PTA. So I was at one of the PTA board meetings and doing a presentation on fire safety. And she put together Tricia, fire department. How many could there be? So it turns out that every year after that, our kids were going to school together and I was invited to her son's birthday party who I had helped deliver.
Oh my God, that is so cool. So,
yeah. Wow. Yeah. Just there's a lot of cool connections like that and stories that I could go on and on about.
Oh, I can only imagine. Now, are there any like wackadoodle ones where like just crazy, like, oh my gosh, I can't believe, you know, I mean, just like any come to mind?
Oh God.
I know, can't get too vile.
It's
always good to have like what that story would you be telling me if we were sitting in the bar right now? I'd be like, this one time, I can't believe. What comes to mind with you when I say what kind of shenanigans would go on in the firehouse?
You know, a lot of them, luckily, in my exposure, I wasn't part of any of them that went awry. We did have one, and this was a good friend of mine was involved with this, where they had a newer person who, I don't remember the whole story exactly, but it was something to the effect of they had been talking at the dinner table about how there was a prison nearby and someone had escaped from the prison and yada yada. And I'm going to mess up the story, but basically someone went across the street after they played card to buy like lottery tickets at the AM/PM and they dressed up in a mask. And when the firefighter was coming back to the station, so the guy ends up running, screaming, calling the police. Police helicopters are out. That one went so bad. And I was so thankful. I was not involved with that at all. But that's the extreme side. I mean, we did, one of the guys on my crew didn't like scary movies. And we had watched a scary movie one night. We talked him into it. And another guy on the crew ended up hiding in his locker for like an hour and a half.
Just waiting.
Popped out and scared him when he was falling asleep.
That's awesome.
I mean, we just kind of silly, stupid stuff. But yeah, it's, you know, we see such heavy stuff and we really do go through so many challenges trying to find a way to lighten it up. And I feel like overall as a whole, we do a really good job trying to make each other laugh and keep a good perspective and a good humor on life. We can't fix everything. We just do the best we can, being okay with
it. Well, so it wasn't long after I met you, and I think I met you up in Sacramento. And so it wasn't very long after, and I was actually at home reading a news article because there had been an incident in Las Vegas that happened and there was a shooting, you know, everything that goes along with that. But then I'm flipping through this news article about a local fireman where I live and I'm reading about him and his girlfriend. And as I'm reading through it, I see Trish Paulette mentioned in this article. My heart dropped, my jaw dropped. Go, oh my God, why is her name in here? Tell me, why was your name in that article?
We had been at the concert in Las Vegas, the Route 91 Harvest Festival, and we're having a wonderful weekend with some friends. Bruce and I were there with another couple. He works for the fire department also, and then another guy who I went through the fire academy with, who's also with our fire department. And we were watching the concert, and there was this nice couple in front of us that we started talking to. Turned out he worked for the fire department as well, and we'd been talking to him and his girlfriend for probably about an hour. He'd gone and bought a round of beers, and we were hoping the person that was passed out on the ground in front of us wouldn't throw up on our boots. Next thing you know, we're kind of holding our ground and going to enjoy watching Jason Aldean. And a few songs in, the shooting started and the guys thought that it was firecrackers. And I looked around and I saw a group of people off to the side pull back. I was trying to convince them. I felt really strongly that it was shooting, that it wasn't firecrackers. And something I saw off to the side, everybody backed up like when there's a fight, but I thought, oh, those must be firecrackers. And there was no smoke and no smell. And then it became very real when Christina had I didn't realize she leaned in and told Kelly she couldn't catch her breath. What I saw was Christina falling to the ground, and she had been shot in the chest. And so we, Bruce, Kelly, and I all got to the ground, and our other friend Ed, and I sent Ed for help, and not really realizing how big of a thing this was going to be. And so it turned out that I looked and I saw blood pouring out of sight of Christina's chest and realized she had been shot. And then our whole focus turned.
You have been listening to San Diego Fire Battalion Chief Tricia Paulette describe what it was like to find herself and the love of her life beneath a terrifying shower of gunfire. This was a mass casualty emergency incident they would normally be responding to as firefighters, but were now in a different role. Be sure to subscribe and catch the next episode of Her Brotherhood, where Trish shares with us the life-changing details that followed.